Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hith Lede. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great ATQ writers, Badwater. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, all things considered. You know, it's that time of the winter, you know, the February before March Madness, where, you know, it's do or die for a lot of teams and including the Oregon teams.
Yeah, I was sort of, you know, I've sort of given up on Oregon getting an at-large bid. I guess there's technically a path for it, but it requires pulling off some victories that just seem like out of reach for a team that's this up and down. Although, you know, never count Altman out in terms of just winning the tournament and taking a bid. And if that's their only path, you know, like, I don't know, man, maybe like take a couple of weeks off and just, you know what I mean? Like, just, you know, tune up the team, you know, for a couple of games.
It's not like he hasn't done it before. So,
Man. So, since the last time this podcast was recorded, the men's side has, played two games in which, I don't know, maybe there's some hope. You know, they wound up sweeping the mountain schools at home. The Utah game was not really a surprise, since apparently Dana Altman just totally owns the Utes. But then the Colorado one is always funny because, like, whoever the home team is just automatically wins this game, apparently. So I don't know, sort of, yeah, like,
but with the Colorado game, though, there was a little bit of a scare with Dante not playing,
right?
And yeah, there was no information as to what kind of injury or how long term it might be, and lo and behold, Nate Biddle steps up.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if that's a surprise or not. Like, I mean, I guess that there's a story to this team, which is that, you know, if Dante's not at 100%, which he did come back and he played in the Utah game, but, you know, off the bench, you know, only, you know, played, I think, 20 minutes. You know, got 9 points. He looked better, you know, like he honestly didn't look injured, but like I just sort of felt like he was on a timer. Like I think literally he was on a timer.
Yeah, just precautionary.
Sure. You know, the story has been Khalil Ware, or more accurately, just the total absence of Khalil Ware, which, like, Altman's come out and just, I mean, as clearly as a coach ever says, you know, like, a coach is never just going to say that dude's a bum and I'm sitting him because, you know, he's dragging his ass in practices and not playing to the standard, and this kid's never going to go to the NBA until he, you know, shapes up. This one and done stuff is a dream for him, and he needs to work harder than he had to work in high school. Coach is never going to say that explicitly, but I guess podcasters get to. And I can read between the lines in what, you know, Altman says, and like, I've been listening to Coach speak for a long time, and what he was saying was that clear as a bell, you know?
Right. And it's articulated in minutes played.
Yeah. Well, so, specifically zero.
Nothing, you know, like that, like, to send a message on, you know, you're gonna earn your minutes. That's for sure.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, Oregon needs a big, you know, there's an opening, you know, with Dante, you know, on the bench or coming off the bench, and the guy who steps into it is Nate Biddle. And, you know, what's funny is that, like, I kind of feel like Nate Biddle was in the Khalil Ware situation a little bit last year. You know, I do think that there were some people anyway who were talking about Biddle being a one and done guy, and here he is a second year, and I sort of think it's because, you know, the tough love message got through. So I don't know. This is getting awfully close to like sports movie cliches, and I don't want to engage in that. But like, I don't know, man. It's difficult to think that Dana Altman is wrong about Kal-El Ware. Definitely the time that I've seen him on the floor, looks like that's an accurate diagnosis. And it's also difficult as an Oregon fan not to hope that Altman's, prognosis is the correct one as well. I hope that guy shapes up. Oregon could use all hands on deck, especially because apparently this team can't stop getting injured this year.
Yeah. That was the scariest part of what happened with Dante in warmups at Colorado was, the prospect of him being out for an extended period of time here going into February. That is a really bad omen. And I was thinking that when I was watching the game. Oh my gosh. But like you say, I didn't see him hobbling at all during the Utah game. So, as I say, they were looked like they were just taking precautionary measures and limiting minutes. And from what I understand, he asked to come off the bench and not start that game. So I forget who reported that. Might have been Crepea.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult to figure out. Who's pushing what. All you can do is observe who's playing and who's not. And the other interesting thing about these two games is the lineup. The lineup winds up being fairly similar, but on the other hand, who's producing, the stat lines are all different. Richardson has a 10-point swing. Cousinard has a 10-point swing. Soares has 9 points in one game, 3 points in another game. Keyshawn Barthelemy, sort of like came out of nowhere to be the second leading scorer against Colorado, and then he goes right back to nowhere against Utah. It's not going to surprise anybody to learn that I think this is a very talented team. I think everybody who looks at Oregon's roster says this is a very talented team. And one of the nice things about having really, talented team is that if you keep rotating them through, you'll figure out which dude's hands are hot that night and you can just ride those guys. And if that, hey, what's the team slogan? Sometimes you, sometimes me. Definitely feels like that. I sort of wish they would be able to settle on us. We were joking about it initially, but I really wish they would just settle on a starting lineup, and that those guys would play consistently. We were joking about using February to tune up for the Pac-12 tournament, but it feels like it's only partially joking. It feels like that's definitely no, that's what's happening. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, and who was kind of an interesting player off the bench was Luck Wirr. He had limited minutes, but I thought in both games he did a lot with the minutes that he was given. And
against Utah, he scores no points, but I think he's plus 17 on his minutes. He's apparently the most effective player that Oregon has who never scores a basket.
Yeah, totally a defensive presence there in the Utah game. In Colorado, he went 2 for 3.
Three-pointer. I'm not sure that I would attribute it entirely to War, but I would say that both of these games were 100% won on the defense because, in both games, Oregon's offense is simply performing nominally as a basketball team is supposed to. They're shooting about 50% from the floor. They're shooting about 33% from the 3-point range. They're making most of their free throws. You know, in fact, it's kind of crazy. Like if you take the individual players out of it and you just look at the, you know, the global stat line looks like nominal basketball performance. If you look at the defensive stat line, oh my God, they just destroyed, you know, both Colorado and Utah, right? Like against Oregon, Colorado
totally on the glass,
right? Colorado shoots 37% from the floor against Oregon and across both halves, you know, like it's not like there's a spike in one, you know, like, nope, it was just consistently, they're shooting 37%. No one wins a basketball game shooting 37% from the floor. Utah shoots 28% from the floor. I don't think there's ever in the history of a basketball, you know, game been a team that shot 28% from the floor and even sniffed a victory. Like, you know, it's all, and like, look, to some extent, those guys' hands were cold. I watched those games. Like, you know, sometimes dudes' hands go cold. Hands going cold explains, you know, shooting like 45% or 42% or something. Like the, you know, defensive involvement is required for, you know, shooting that poorly the way the Mountain Schools did. And, you know, hey, if Oregon wants to be a defensive led team, I'm all for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, like Altman, has said, year in and year out, the offense will go up and down. But if your defense is there, then yeah, you stand a chance to ride out the runs, you know, in the spurts and offense.
I mean, it's definitely a viable model. You know, if you can, you know, consistently demonstrate good defense to hold your opponent to like, you know, 10% lower shooting than what their hands are like that night, then even if they're hot, you know, you can still, you know, restrict them. And if they're cold, you can kind of sleepwalk through it. And then on offense, if you just have a very talented team and you're willing to rotate through until you find the hot five, for whatever that combination is that night, because you have a big and talented enough roster that you can do that. Like, dude, you just described like a team that's not going to lose any basketball games, which is pretty much what Oregon needs to be if they want to make the tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, especially this coming weekend. It kind of feels like a do or die weekend in the desert. And yeah, especially since Arizona's going to want revenge in the worst way for their beatdown in Eugene.
Yeah, and definitely. And I mean, that game is in Tucson and they're going to get McHale officiating. So, you know, Oregon's pretty much going to have to play perfect basketball against a team at home that has a significant home court advantage and which is desperate for revenge. Yeah, you know, it's what I mean. I have this game penciled in as a loss, you know, just sort of by default, which is why I say like I it's that or beat UCLA, you know, is, you know, what our colleague, Adam Holland, you know, suggested is like, you know, they got to beat at least one of those teams if they want an at-large bid. And the way that I look at it, you know, like, you know, they did play UCLA fairly close and that was, at UCLA the first time around and they get them, you know, in Eugene, you know, the next time, a couple days before Valentine's Day, so I don't know, we'll see, you know, it's definitely a possibility. But like, I don't know, man, I just really have a hard time seeing him beat Arizona. What would be nice is to get out of the desert, you know, with at least one win, which means, you know, beating Arizona State, a team that humiliated them, the Ducks on their own court, last time they played, but like, I don't know, maybe they'll return the favor. Like,
right. Yeah. They really do. They need a split in the worst way.
Yeah. I mean, at least a split, you know, the Yep. It's just like they can't come out of that 0-2. Like they might actually just straight up kill the season. They might just be so demoralized by going 0-2 in the desert that like it doesn't even matter. But I don't know, man. Like the Altman haters and the Altman lovers have both had a lot of ammunition to load up over the last month. I don't really count myself in either one of those camps, but I do count myself in the camp of like, never count out Dana Altman. Like, I think he's one of the best working coaches, in the country. And, you know, it ain't over till it's over, you know, like it ain't over until that team is eliminated from the Pac-12 tournament. And that's, you know, and they definitely have time for a tune up before then. So we'll keep going and we'll keep covering it. Addicted to Quack. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the women's side. So the women's side has sort of faced some different challenges from the men's side. They, rather than having two mountain schools that they sort of rolled over at home, instead went on a trip to the Bay Area. They took on Cal in a game that probably should have been easier than it was. It was actually like a thriller of a game. I genuinely enjoyed it. It was something like 25 lead changes. It's just that Cal's not that good and Oregon should have blown him out. But wherever, you know, we got a good, you know, at least an enjoyable game out of it. We're enjoyable for, at least from the perspective of a neutral basketball fan. If you were an Oregon fan who was like, why aren't they destroying these ladies? It maybe was less enjoyable, but anyway, they did get the win. You know, they pulled it out when they needed to. And then they went to Stanford and sort of got crushed. Although at points during the Stanford game, they looked a hell of a lot more competitive. Like, that, you know, they look like the team that they're supposed to be against a very good team. But then other parts of the game, they just like look like in a total affront to basketball in which like neither team could make a shot. Is that your review of the ladies trip to the Bay Area as well?
Yeah. The I don't know why it is that California was giving them fits. Other than, you know, they were certainly shooting the three better. I think that's what really kept.
Oh, Cal, yeah. In the well, game was Cal the was shooting shot. The three at an acceptable rate, and Oregon was shooting the three at like half of the rate that they should have. Like, you know, there's a stretch in the middle of the game where I think they shot 13, they made 13. 3-point attempts and scored zero of them. Right. You know, it was just like, what's happening? I mean, it was just like horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Constantly throwing up bricks. And, you know, we have all these good shooters, but yeah, with the roster size, Oregon's not really in a very good position to be able to withstand all their shooters shooting poorly from beyond the arc. And yeah, we saw that on full display with both the Bay Area games where yeah, it was just a cold hand. And if the other team gets a hot hand, well, then it makes things more difficult. With the Cal game, they were able to have a better inside presence and yeah, use that to their advantage.
Well, I mean, Cal, I don't really feel like Cal got hot. You know, they it's not true. In the third quarter, Cal got inexplicably hot. It felt like in the third quarter, Cal couldn't miss a shot. And they were contested shots. I mean, it was kind of crazy. Like, you know, there was a lot of times where I felt like Oregon's defense was totally there. The hand was totally in her face. And it was like, it wasn't even like, you know, shooters bounce like rimming in or something like that. It was like they were swishing it every time. And then they went, you know, but then they, you know, the reason that Oregon won that game, ultimately, it was a very tight game. Oregon did not shoot well from the 3-point line. But Cal went cold, in the fourth quarter, and Oregon didn't. And that's it. That's why Oregon wins by 5. Like, I don't really put that down to an awesome, you know, offensive performance by Cal or anything. I just think that, you know, it really just sort of comes down to Oregon was just terrible at shooting threes. Like, I mean, like, Chance Gray's stat line in this game is particularly crazy. She goes 1-for-7 from the floor, 0-for-4 from the 3-point line, 10-for-10 from the charity stripe. Like, Cal couldn't stop fouling her. Like, even though she couldn't make a bucket to save her life, Cal couldn't stop fouling her, and she just made every one of her free throws. Like, it's not like I've never seen a stat line like that, but you rarely see a stat. Usually they just sort of figure out, like, guys, we don't need to hack her or anything. Give her an open look, she'll blow it. Like, but yeah. Cal never figured that out.
No, Chance has been really good on the charity stripe this year. So it wasn't particularly amazing that she hit the vast majority of her free throws. And if they had done the least little bit of scouting, they would have known that's not the person that you want to be fouling. But it is kind of disconcerting that she can't hit a shot from the field.
Well, yeah, and like...
And she's not the only one.
I'm not really surprised by that at this point. Like, she's had such an up-and-down season. The one that I'm... Well, there's two players who that I was sort of surprised by in the Cal game. You know, one... Taya Hansen, who just had a real clunker of a performance, and like Hansen has been like a hero of a couple of games, right? Yeah. It's but like, you know, 2-for-7 from the floor, and like she was the worst defender in terms of like jacking up threes and missing. She's 0-for-5, and just like for somebody who's you know. Like Taya Hansen is built right. Like I would not want to encounter Taya Hansen in a dark alley. She'd beat the crap out of me.
No, she'd kick both of our asses probably at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Her interior presence is just negative. It is the absence of an interior presence. She draws no fouls. I'm not saying that she's afraid of contact or anything, but it's like she needs to be pressing inside and drawing fouls, and she never does. And I don't get it. And you know, the last lady that I complained about, like, I don't get it, was Filipina Che not taking shots, but lo and behold, she started taking shots. You know, against Cal, she was 5-for-6. She looked great. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, she discovered her offense. So like, maybe it's me, you know, like maybe I'll light a fire under Taya Hansen's ass. That'd be great. And I mean, even Stanford, you know, Stanford was a great team. And frankly, might win it all this year. I mean, this kind of looks like maybe the best team that Vandeviers ever had. But anyway, like, she's shooting even more against Stanford. Like, she shot, you know, she put it up 12 times, you know, against Stanford. While maintaining her like total, you know, rebound dominance. And you could tell that Stanford was altering their defensive strategy to deal with her, and it was creating offensive opportunities for the rest of the team. The problem was against Stanford is that those offensive opportunities the rest of the team were getting were they were just like completely whiffing on them, right? Like, okay, so Van Sluten is 3-for-14 from the floor. She usually doesn't get that many shot opportunities. That's coming off of Che. And Dia Rogers is 3-for-14 from the floor as well. She usually does that get that many shot opportunities, usually doesn't miss that badly, and Tahina Papau is 2-for-14 from the floor. Like, you know, Elise Hurst for some reason was getting 20 minutes despite shooting 1-for-9 from the floor. Taya Hansen had another stinker of a night. They just shot, you know, absolutely terribly against Stanford, but like they were getting lots of shot on goal opportunity. They attempted 80 field goals. against Stanford. And they were doing that because like Stanford kept having to trap Che. And it's like, that's what you get when you have a giant big, you need to take advantage of it. And just like yet another game in which their hands are completely soaked in ice, like liquid, like is Kelly Graves traveling to the Bay Area with like big buckets of liquid nitrogen to stick their hands in before the game. I don't get it, man. Like you had an excellent offensive strategy, you know, to set up these, you know, perimeter shooting opportunities and kickouts, and like, and they just weren't able to capitalize on it at all. You know, like they just set the game basketball back 20 years, just like a horrendous shooting performance. Like put the ball in the basket. Like this ain't rocket science, man.
Right. And they had plenty of open looks.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Stanford was letting them shoot the bricks. If you're going to throw bricks up, I'm going to let you do it. Philly's play is kind of a tale of two halves, because initially she had some issues with Cameron Brink, who's
I mean, well, most people
she might be one of the best players in the country. I mean, she's arguably the best player in the Pac-12, and she's kind of deceptive. She's a really skilled, she's only 6'4", but she has this huge wingspan.
Yes.
It's like when I was doing rehab with turkey vultures have just an enormous wingspan for their body size.
Are you literally talking about the bird turkey vultures?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Usually wingspan is a metaphor is all.
Yeah. No, I'm literally talking wingspan. Right. A bald eagle has a bigger body size, but a shorter wingspan. The turkey vulture has a longer wingspan that allows them to.
Well, yeah, they're long-term gliders, whereas eagles are raptors.
Yeah. And Brink is like that too. She's 6'4", but has a reach, and we saw that with all the blocks that she did. Philly only scored a couple of points in the first half, but adjusted to it and that kind of thing. And she was really a presence in the second half. I thought that she handled Brink's defense much better. And I mean, she's a young player and still new, and so it's encouraging to see that kind of turnaround in a single game rather than, I'll be better next year.
Yeah, I mean, if there's something to take away from the Bay Area trip, even though, look, they split it, they lost the game that they were supposed to lose, they won the game they were supposed to win, I suppose you should take that as victory. I don't, because the Cal game was closer than it should have been, and because the Stanford game looked like it was winnable. Like, that's the other thing, is that, like, you know, Stanford shot 37% from the floor. That's a winnable game. But Oregon shot 25% from the floor. Like, come on, they're not going to give you that gift, you know, but once in a blue moon. And like, if you can't take advantage of it because your hands are even colder, like, it's just pathetic. I don't feel real great about this Bay Area trip, but if there's one silver lining to it, it's like, I get to see Shea shoot. And like, I hope that's not just, you know, momentary thing. You know, I hope that that's, you know, a real thing going forward.
I think so. I think we've been seeing progress in her play as the season has advanced, and hopefully come Pac-12 tournament time, you know, she's gained enough experience to be able to utilize her height. Yeah, if she uses that, she can.
I mean, the
take on most any of the opponents.
I mean, it's such a, I mean, look, man, like, this ain't the men's side in which, you know, you can find 7-footers for every team in the country, like, or at least every team that's a contender. Like, you on the women's side, that is, that ought to be an unassailable, you know, advantage against 90% of the teams that you play. And her not shooting for most of the year was like, I mean, it was the craziest thing. Like, it was like such a massive missed opportunity that they were laboring under. And if they're, you know, finally fixing that, then like, okay, I like this team. You know, I really like this team's chances to go pretty far in the tournament, you know, if they have that weapon, because like just structurally, it's a, there's such a mismatch advantage there that doesn't exist on the other side. Like, yeah, it just doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk about the football recruiting class. So I wrote a non-film study article this week, actually this morning. It was, although all I really did was like tapped into my database, which I have to maintain anyway. I just went through the 2023 signing class and noted, you know, what everybody's talent ratings are, and then basically like what the situation is at each of their positions, given the returners, the departures, and the transfers in, and started to make some guesses about who might be getting some early playing time. It was actually a pretty simple article to write, and so therefore a lot of fun, because I had the computer write most of it, like, because the computer is able to make all these guesses. It's great. I sort of coded a couple of things in Python a few years ago, and like there are half my articles get written for me by the computer. It's sweet. The thing that sort of overall struck me before we start talking about specifics, but the thing that sort of overall struck me is what I had to write a couple of times or instruct the computer to write for me, is that like Oregon doesn't need freshmen to play at any of these positions. Like, they have the number one recruiting class in the Pac-12. It will be their fifth straight year with the number one recruiting class in the Pac-12. And I tell you what, like, any other team in the Pac-12 has this signing class, like half of these dudes are going to be slated to play as starters, because the roster management of the Pac-12 is so bad that like, if you get some blue chips, you're going to play those blue chips because they're just instantly better than anybody that you have, or maybe they're the only guy that you have. And like, even with all the attrition that, you know, Oregon has had, they've had a lot of people exit the portal, and they're probably going to have more, and not probably, they 100% have to have more. There are at least seven, you know, scholarships over the cap, right now. Like, it's the Oregon is in the fortunate position of having had good roster management for the last 5 years, and such that, you know, the guys who leave are basically the guys for whom it's appropriate for them to leave. And the way that the replacements have come in, has been, and the way that, you know, the returners have returned, like, has been to the point where Oregon is a position where the only true freshmen that they're going to have to play are true freshmen who, like, you can't keep off the field. I can't predict who exactly that's going to be, but like, you recruited a class this good, there's going to be like 3-4 guys in it who are like, oh, that guy's so good, he's just like, you know, can't keep them off the field. And those are luxuries, you know, those aren't necessities.
Yeah, kind of like Connerly last year.
Yeah, sure. You can go through Oregon's history over the last, you know, several years and find plenty of examples where it's like, you know, that you didn't have to play, but like, you know, the closest thing that Oregon has to like a gap that definitely needs to be filled is, you know, they didn't really have an edge rush last year, and like all their outside linebackers, except for, you know, Funa and a couple of true freshmen who had redshirted, you know, have departed. And so like, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised to see, you know, a true freshman play, maybe two, maybe three, you know, true freshman play, you know, but they brought in, you know, as a transfer, they brought in Jordan Birch, mm-hmm. you know, former five-star, you know, Jordan Birch, who like, it's entirely possible they just play him. He's their pass rush, and that's it. The freshman could redshirt, you know, like the I mean, that's the other side of this coin, is that like the transfer class is so good, and Lanning's track record on transfers from last year is so amazing, right? Like, they took 9 transfers from last year. 8 of them were home runs, you know. Yeah. Like, their track record, I guess I'm mixing metaphors pretty badly there, baseball and track, but like, in a football podcast, but like, they're like, I just have like 100% confidence that like every single dude, that they got out of the transfer portal is, you know, going to be a solid contributor. And so therefore, even at the positions where I think they sort of have some roster holes, they've already been plugged, and the true freshmen aren't necessities. And like, man, oh man, for a number one recruiting class, for all of these guys to potentially just be red shirts or, you know, that they could redshirt and it would be fine, is just not a situation that any other team in the Pac-12 is in.
Yeah, it's crazy when you can even begin to entertain that thought. And the transfers, like we talked about last year, they fit all the right holes, and they really fold into the incoming recruiting class well. You know, like you say, I think we're seeing another, you know, home run performance in the transfer portal.
Well, you would expect, you know, like, and I mean, of course, they're all, you know, immediate contributors at this point in the evolution of college football and roster management. If you're taking a transfer who's not supposed to be an immediate impact player, like, what are you doing? You know, like, you're not taking these guys as projects. Like, right. So like, I, you know, I fully expect everybody, you know, that they took to play either as a starter or as a, you know, a solid rotational guy. I would, you know, like, there's a couple of redundancies, like, it's, but I mean, we'll find out. You know, I expect, like, you know, they took 10 of them. I fully would expect 8 of them to be part of the 2 deep. You know, now there may be some injuries or something, you know, other unforeseen, you know, events, but like, you know, from what I expect, you know, I would expect at least 8 of these guys to be like, yeah, they're definitely part of the 2 deep. That's simply what Dan Lanning's track record is. And, you know, having, you know, knowing what I know about these guys, we'll do a full breakdown of the transfer ins and outs, you know, a little later, because there's still another transfer window. You know, in May, it goes from May 1st to May 15th, which is sort of coincides with Oregon spring ball. So yeah, we'll have to wrap all that up, you know, at a later point. But like, from what I know of these guys at this point, like, yeah, no, these all, you know, look like solid, you know, contributors. But it's just it's a remarkable position to be in, that you can recruit a class this talented, where, you know, each, you know, I in my article, I broke down, you know, basically, you know, into 4, like, sort of not position groups, but like the, you know, whatever the, you know, division, not platoon, you know, so the offensive skill players, the offensive line, the defensive front, and the secondary. And each of those 4, it's, you know, the you know, what their 247 talent, you know, average is, it's a 0.94 for the skill players. It's, you know, it's a 0.90 for the defensive front. It's a 0.89 for the secondary, actually close to a 0.90. And it's 0.8851, which is less than half a hundredth of a point off from being a blue chip. Like, they're all blue chips. And really, it's just because of Bolton. Bryce Bolton, he's an interior offensive lineman, who's a 0.86. He's the guy who's dragging him down from being a blue chip average. And really, that's just because Bolton's, like, I watched his tape. His feet are really good. Like, his footwork is excellent. It's just like, he doesn't have he's not heavy enough. Like, and so that's why he's not a 4-star. 'Cause like, if he puts on the weight, that dude's a blue chip. If he doesn't, that guy is not a viable player. And we just don't, like, that's an open question. We don't know. And that's why he's not a 4-star. But like, man, if that guy weighed, you know, if that guy came into college weighing 20 pounds, you know, heavier, he would be rated high enough so that all four of these position groups or super groups would be, you know, blue chips. Like, man, that ain't, I mean, it's just not even fair to combine like a recruiting class that talented with a man with a roster that's been managed this well so they don't need to play. It's just like it's unheard of in the Pac-12. That's stuff that's much more akin to the teams that I have been studying, like Ohio State and Georgia and so forth.
Yeah. And like you say, when you have all that talent around you, you can work with a player like Bolton, who might be really super essential to the needs of a team with a different makeup.
Yeah.
But yeah, Oregon has a lot of luxury in a lot of different positions in the same manner.
Yeah. And I mean, it also means that you can, the couple of three stars that you do take, you can afford to take projects, you know, like, you know, so Bolton's probably going to be a project. He needs to put on some weight. Colin Gill, the defensive back, is probably going to be a project. You know, he probably, you know, he probably he's a corner, I think. And I think he needs to, you know, the game needs to slow down for him. I think, well, I don't know what I think about Jaden Moore. I think Jaden Moore might just straight up be underrated. He's a mid three star who should probably be rated higher. I don't really understand. Like, his film really pops. It might be because he's a little underweight, so maybe he's a bit of a project too. I don't know. But like, you know, you can or like Tatum Tuiati, the coach's, you know, kid, where like he didn't show his film to anybody because like everybody knew. Because he's going to Sheldon High and everybody knows, you know, what school he's going to. He doesn't need to participate in the camp circuit or anything, so he doesn't really get exposed. But, like, that kid could wind up being phenomenal. You know, like, coaches' kids right. often are. Like, they're very technically proficient for obvious reasons. Like, yeah, you know. Oh, and then the other thing that was fun about writing the article was we got to kick it off with the coup of swiping Roderick Pleasant from USC.
Yes. That's always a good thing.
Who is literally the fastest player, I believe, in the entire recruiting class for the entire country. Like, oh my God. Like I pulled up his track film and his track film is incredible. In fact, that's the header photo for my article is him winning a track meet. It's just like, it's unbelievable watching that. I mean, just totally flies. And like his film is all of as a cornerback, but I think there's a strong possibility that because he has some experience as wide receiver. And I sort of feel like the value to the guy to the team would really be playing as a, you know, just a burner slot receiver. I feel like that, you know, really open stuff up for the offense to just like totally take the top off, you know, which, you know, basically in order to cover him, a safety would have to be covering him. And for a safety to cover him, they just need to bail like immediately. They need to play 10 yards back and they need to be, you know, backpedaling instantly from the snap, and just giving him an enormous cushion, which like either they do that and it opens up everything underneath for outside receivers and wheel routes from the running back and tight ends and so forth. Or they don't, and he's running a post route for a touchdown every play, you know, like, I mean, that kind of speed is really, really valuable out of the slot. And Oregon's pretty much fine at cornerback. Like, they kind of don't need him at cornerback, but like he could be transformative on offense. So it's an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. I can't help but think that the prospect of competing in Hayward Field was a huge impetus in him coming along to Oregon instead of USC.
I think that all of the offensive line guys are going to redshirt. Like some are more projects than others, but it's just Oregon returns. You know, I think they've got four guys who are returning who are, you know, depending on how you squint and look at it, were starters. You know, like Josh Connerly was a starter at the sixth man position, which they were only using sometimes, but like he was a starter at that position, you know. But he's also like a five star and was capable of playing as a true freshman. So like I have no doubt that he's gonna be, you know, part of it. You know, plus they had, you know, they got two pretty good transfers, Johnny Cornelius from Rhode Island, and Junior Angelou from Texas. You know, like I think the one JUCO that they took in the class, George Silva, he might, you know, break in, although that in and of itself is kind of a story. Like, when was the last time Oregon only took one JUCO? Like this class just sort of overall is a real investment in the future. I mean, it's like 26 four stars. It was crazy.
Between, you know, recruiting elite talent and, you know, prodigious use of the transfer portal, that means that a lot of players are leaving Oregon, and they're not Dan Lanning players. They're not the players that Dan Lanning recruited. So Lanning, in his second year, has a higher percentage of his guys than you might otherwise expect.
Oh yeah, it's huge. It's something like three quarters of the roster is going to be a Dan Lanning guy, as you put it, either, you know, recruited out of prep or brought in as a transfer. Yeah, it's pretty wholesale turnover in a very fast order, which is a combination of two things. You know, number one, the transfer portal, and number two, the NCAA waiver that we're on specifically the waiver of the 25 initial counter rule, which is basically being used to, there's a massive backlog caused by the COVID holiday. And basically teams need to clear out their rosters. But you can't clear out your roster unless you can replace guys, you know, and you can't replace guys with the 25 initial counter cap. So they did away with that for this year and for next year. And I don't know, they might extend it. But anyway, Oregon definitely took advantage. I mean, like, I think they handed out, let me do a quick count. 11, 17, 28, like, I think this is something in the neighborhood of 30 prep scholarships on top of 10 transfers coming in. You know, like, you know, 40 new players. Like, yeah, they just completely blew past 25.
It's not an insignificant number at all.
Yeah, right. And like I said, you know, the crazy thing is that they don't really, you know, so it's basically like it's a larger, even if they had 25 initial counters cap, and so they couldn't take any of the 10 transfers that they took, it would still be a more than full prep recruiting class. And it's appropriate, you know, it's all balanced to where the needs are. Like, this is how you would assemble your roster if you weren't able to take any transfers. This is, you would still recruit exactly this roster, this slate of prep recruits. But then they got 10 transfers, you know, to sort of tide them over. It's just like, it's a pretty excellent position to be in. And I mean, like I said, you know, I really sort of was racking my brain to find a guy that, like, you know, I think probably the most likely to get significant playing time is Kenyon Sadiq, the tight end recruit, simply because, you know, with both McCormick and Matafau transferring out, they're down to two scholarship tight ends, which I actually don't really think is the end of the world, because I think that Will Stein is probably going to play mostly out of 11 personnel. And but, like, you know, what happens if one of those guys get hurt, or, you know, just needs a break or something like that, or that he wants to play out of 12 personnel and one of the dude needs some Gatorade at that moment, you know, like. So I think that Sadiq will probably get some playing time, but I think it could actually be limited, and like, because remember, you not only get you get to play in four games without burning your red shirt, but they amended that rule. So it's four games plus the bowl game doesn't count. So it's, you know, really five games. And so, like, I think that even with the guys that I sort of expect to see the field, during the season, there's still scenarios in which they wind up keeping their red shirt. And I think the staff will probably have that as the goal. The other position where I wouldn't be surprised to see is the two outside receivers, Cozart and Dickey. Dickey, because he, you know, when I was saying earlier, like, there's probably at least a couple of guys here that, like, you can't keep them off the field. They're so talented. Like, if there's anybody who fits that build, it's Jurian Dickey. Like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. But, like, that's, you know, inside receiver, they've got enough dudes. I'm not really worried about that. But outside receiver, they pretty much got Franklin. And they've got Trayshawn Holden, the Alabama transfer, who is like 6'3". And they have Kyler Casper, who's like 6'6", but, like, that's it, you know, for tall dudes, you know, which is, like, that's just barely as many as you need, you know, for the rotation. Yeah, so I could definitely see Cozart and Dickey, you know, playing simply to supplement the outside receiver rotation. Beyond that, and, like, I, you know, simply because Carlos Lachlan, the running backs coach, you know, likes to have a four-man rotation, and because he's been pretty comfortable playing Jordan James, who was a true freshman last year, I sort of expect that, like, the two running back recruits, Dowdle and Lamar, you know, you'll probably wind up see probably Dowdle, I think, because, like, that guy's big, you know, might wind up playing. I don't know. Novacek, like, I don't really know what the deal with Ty Thompson is. Like, I'm still sort of willing to give him some benefit of the doubt that, like, maybe the absolute disaster every time he was in wasn't exactly his fault. There were sort of, like, crazy circumstances surrounding him. Like, he might not be a bust. I don't know. But, like, I definitely think that Novacek, you know, gives him a shot at having a different, you know, who the backup is, dude, quarterback. He was probably the most, like, necessary recruit of the entire, you know, class, in terms of, like, you have to have a functional backup quarterback, and there's a good possibility that that's not Ty Thompson. And if it's not, they, you know,
yeah, like, absolutely.
But, like, I don't know, man, like, we're down, you know, pretty far down, like, speculative paths there. And then on defense, like I said, you know, they have a hole at edge rush, but, like, that's what they took Jordan Birch for. On the other hand, like, you know, they took some dudes. Like, this defensive line, like, it is unusual to see a defensive line unit with a blue chip average. And it's a blue chip average because they took a couple of guys who were, like, really highly rated, like Mataiu Uiagalelei. And I don't know, some of these guys are going to be difficult to keep off the field. Like, there are some guys who just, like, the tape looks phenomenal. Blake Purchase's tape looks really, really good. I think they're basically set at the interior line positions. And so I'm sort of expecting a lot of these guys to redshirt, and it won't be any knock on them. You know, it's just sort of similar to the offensive line side, where it's like, hey, they got their guys, you know, like, why don't you hit the training table and we'll see you next year. You know, kind of situation, but on the edge, they definitely need help. And it's also sort of difficult to, like, sort out, 'cause there's, like, there's a defensive in the structure of this, there's the defensive end position, which is different from the outside linebacker position. And then on top of that, the outside linebacker position, it's different whether or not you're playing on the strong side or the weak side. And then on top of that, they have two guys who are true freshmen this year, Jaden Moore and Ashton Porter, both of whom their films look really good. Who on the official roster, they're calling them edge, which, like, Oregon didn't use that designation last year. So I don't know what that means. So, like, they have, for guys who are not defensive tackles, they have, like, three or arguably four different positions that are all different. And I sort of think that's kind of fluid, and we'll just have to see sort of how their bodies develop over spring and fall camp for where they might slot in. So I don't know. I mean, obviously it's the position I'm going to be watching. And then I don't know, like,
you and me and everybody else.
Well, I mean, yeah, right. It was the thing that was absent from Oregon's defense, you know, definitely. Yeah. You know, the other positions are pretty easy to figure out, though. You know, like, inside linebacker, they've got two returners, two true freshmen, or excuse me, two guys who were red for true freshmen last year who redshirted. They brought in two transfers, you know, so, you know, they only got one prep recruit. He's a mid to high three star. He's probably going to redshirt. Like, that's easy to figure out. It's easy to figure out the cornerback room because Oregon brings back, you know, they're, you know, a bunch of productive quarterbacks, and these guys, you know, probably going to redshirt. The safety unit, I don't know. There could be a shake because they have a new coach. And there still could be guys who leave. In fact, like, there's a couple of dudes in the safety unit, you know, given that Oregon has to shed a bunch of scholarships, I sort of have my eye on a couple of dudes who I sort of think, you know, might see the door. And if they do, then maybe that's an opportunity for a true freshman to play. But on the other hand, they took, you know, look, they took Kyrie Jackson from Alabama. They took Evan Williams from Fresno. They took Tysheem Johnson, who's probably the star, from Ole Miss. Like, you know, it's entirely possible that any holes that are created, you know, just immediately get plugged by transfers and all the freshmen just redshirt, which is what I was saying at the beginning of this segment, is like, they don't need any of these guys to play. Like, every single guy who I'm sort of putting my finger on is maybe this guy gets some playing time as a true freshman. Like, it's all speculative because, like, there's no position. Like, when I do this process for other Pac-12 teams, the way they identify which true freshmen are playing is not by looking at that true freshman's tape. I don't care about their tape. What I do is I look at the tape that I already have of those teams' returners and the guys who I know are absent, and I say, like, well, there's a yawning void at this position, and they got to play the true freshman. And, like, yeah. There's nothing like that for Oregon, so I don't get to do that exercise. Like, you know, it's, yeah, I know it's a good problem to have. Woe is me. It's hard for me to figure out which true freshmen are going to play. You know, what a terrible situation.
Indeed.
I even wrote about the specialists just for completeness' sake. Oregon took the number one place kicker in the country, Grant Metters, who is interestingly also the number 53 punter in the country, evaluated by the same organization, Chris Saylor Kicking. Nick Dizanski, the long snapper that they took, is the number 7 best long snapper in the universe, according to Rubio Long Snapping, an organization that I learned today that existed. The question is punting. It was a real mess last year. They had like 3 different dedicated punters, none of whom were very reliable. And in fact, you know, at the end there, against Oregon State, there's some catastrophes, you know, on,
yeah, punting was pretty awful.
The only specialist that they gave a scholarship to this cycle was Luke Dunn, who's out of Australia, which, like, hooray, an Australian kicker. On the other hand, the sort of the downside to that is just the way that they come up in Australia. They don't produce a bunch of film for you to take a look at. So, like, I don't have any links for the guy. I don't know if he can perform. They don't have, like, the equivalent of Saylor or Rubio that gives, you know, star ratings to specialists. So, like, I don't know. He's sort of a black box. I guess we'll find out.
You'd have to be looking at Australian football stuff and, Australian football is very odd, but they do utilize kickers in a similar manner to punters in American football. So, you know, it's conceivable he's got a foot.
I mean, yeah, I don't, I'm sort of film studied out. Like, I'm at capacity. I can't add another sport to do film study on just to evaluate punters. sorry, everybody.
Football. This is football.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That would be the other problem. It's like, I couldn't keep a bunch of Crocodile Dundee references. My writing on the situation. I don't know. Like, I mean, that's sort of the thing, though. It's, I'm not really much of an expert in evaluating, like, high school tape. Like, I watch a guy and I say, okay, he doesn't look like a bum. But, like, that's about as far as I can get. Because, like, what I really need is, since I'm a college film reviewer, is to watch him play against other college athletes. Like, I'm pretty good at evaluating transfers if I get to that project. I don't know if I will, though. I'm not really actually sure how I'm going to spend my off season. You know, last season I filled it all up with all the whole new coaching staff, right? Because, like, you know, everybody was a replacement and everybody had some film to watch. But this year it's only been 2, you know, replacements. Looks like Clem is sticking put. So like, I don't know, maybe I'll go through some of these, like these transfers guys film before spring ball starts up. Well, maybe that'll be my next project. It certainly was, you know, like I said, it was fun to write about the new kids, but like, you know, like I've been saying throughout the segment, like I kind of don't expect to see any of the new kids this season. So like, I don't know how profitable it would be to look at these guys.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll find out. It'd be a pleasant surprise if our punting dramatically improves this year, because we certainly needed it last season.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, that's the other thing, by the way, about Roderick Pleasant, that's sort of the under the radar coup about it, is his film as a kick returner looks really good, and Oregon could definitely use some better, you know, field position off of punts. Yeah, that'd be pretty sweet. It's entirely possible that he winds up, you know, I spent this whole time talking about all the early signees who might see the field. The latest signee of them all might be the guy that they need the most.
The track stuff that I've seen on him is pretty incredible.
Oh yeah,
and that guy has jets like nobody's business.
All right, I think we'll wrap it up there. You got any parting words of wisdom for us?
Nope. Just go Ducks. I'm looking forward to it, to the spring game already.
I mean, as soon as the end of the bowl game happens, then it's like, well, when's spring game? When's spring game? Yeah. All right, thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.